From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I wish that when I was a college freshman, a course like Harvard's seminar called Tree had been part of the curriculum, because since I learned about the class last year, I've never looked at a tree quite the same way again. It's not a botany course, nor one for aspiring arborists, despite its name. A sentence from the syllabus for Tree hints at its core intention. Imagine a semester devoted to connecting two organisms, it reads. A person, you, and a tree, not you. And then it adds this. The goal of this freshman seminar will be to initiate a personal and lifelong connection with the other, the vast and variant organisms with which we share the planet. The creator of the class is the director of Harvard's Arnold Arboretum, evolutionary biologist Ned Friedman, and he's here today to tell us more about it and about what we can each learn from making a connection to a tree. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Since 2011, Ned Friedman has been director of the Arnold Arboretum of Harvard University, a 281-acre world-renowned collection of woody plants founded some 150 years ago. In 2020, he created the curriculum for a new freshman seminar called Tree, and each fall since, about a dozen students join him on the adventure it promises. I'm so glad to welcome him to the program today to learn more about some lessons the trees have to teach us. How are you, Ned?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Sun's shining and the arboretum is right in front of me.
Seen any good trees lately? You only have 16,000, right?
Yeah, I it's hard to narrow down, but the other day I had to do a little bit of a pilgrimage to our Chinese witch hazels. And there was one that was just glowing gold. It was magnificent. So yes, I'm making my little steps and stops around the arboretum.
Well, out my window, Palado, which is an intermediate hybrid, I think, and is in one direction, and the out the other window is, I don't know if you say Jelena or Yelena or what, J-E-L-E-N-A, which is sort of an orangey-ish kind of rusty-colored one. So I have two blooming right now, too, yes.
Yeah, they're just something wonderful. We have one of the hybrids, I think Diane, which has much redder, and that one's having a phenomenal year. So winter flowering is just one of these things I think is so counterintuitive to so many people. We have that winter sweet Chimonanthus.
Yes.
And it was so cold this year that I thought all of the flower buds that were sitting out there shivering were going to be frozen and weren't going to come out. And then I got a tip off from the keeper of the living collections, Michael Dosman. Oh, it's on.
Yay.
So I made my pilgrimage over there.
Yeah.
And of course, 20 feet away, you can close your eyes and you can just smell your way into a point source of incredibly beautiful aromas.
Nose. So I'm a few years past freshman age, but it's never too late for sort of the life enriching and heart opening teachings in your seminar called Tree. I think, having learned about it from you when we did a time story not long ago, a New York Times story, you know, I was so grateful to learn about it, and I've thought a lot about it since. And I wonder if you could just tell us sort of the brief version of the premise of the class and how it works. It's not the stereotypical course where every session is held in a lecture hall or anything, exactly.
Right. And actually, these freshman or first-year seminars at Harvard are, and I think many other universities and colleges have similar programs, they're really intended to get away from that lecture, you know, classroom sort of format and have a sort of a liberation from the standard pedagogical approaches. And so, in a way, you can create anything you want for these. It's a pass-fail class. It's not for 4 credits. I think it's just 1 credit. And you meet once a week. And I When I got to Harvard, I just thought this was just sounds like such an interesting thing to explore. And the first thing I did was I actually created a course that followed Charles Darwin's life through his writings, and I mean through his actual correspondence. And then we actually looked at his cereal obsessions, from earthworms to orchids to you name it. And part of what I was trying to do there was to use Darwin as an example of a life well lived, one that follows passions, one that had a wonderful family and a close-knit network of friends and correspondents and allies. And in a way, I just let his voice speak. And so I look at these opportunities, the first semester of a freshman or a first-year student, as an opportunity to really insert some experience that allows the students to ponder, in the big scheme of things, what it means to have a good life, a meaningful life, a connected life. And I had done that Darwin seminar for almost a decade. And I just thought, what if I could get some of the essence of the Arboretum and what I feel when I was just describing to you how it feels to be, standing next to this gold cloud of witch hazels in the snow. I know I feel that these connections, and I know that the Arboretum and the sort of presence of trees has changed my life. And so I thought, what if I could flip that around and create an experience for first-year students that might have a lasting effect on their sense of being connected to the natural world and sensitive and aware and awake to it? And my thought was that in creating connections to the other, if you can do that, and you do it as a practice, you're probably going to be a more empathic kind of a person, a more rooted kind of a person. And so that was my goal, truly, to do those things.
So you start the first class, I believe. You take a walk, the group takes a walk with you across sort of the Arboretum. And again, there's like 16,000 or something woody plants there. And I think you explain to them that they're each going to choose a tree that will be kind of their partner for this course. Yes.
Exactly right. So it's about a mile long, the Arboretum, and they Uber out, and I meet them a mile from where we're going to actually have our conversations and discussions about the readings each week. And it rain or shine, we just march. This is, well, it's either day one of the semester or it's day six of the semester, depending on where the calendars fall. But yeah, I mean, they barely arrived, and we just have this joyful walk. They're getting to know each other. I'm unpacking a little of the Arboretum and Olmsted's design history and the collections, and we look at this thing, and then in the background, I'm telling them that look around carefully because you're going to come back and you're going to wander this place without me, and you're going to have to find one of these woody plants that you're going to actually visit with every week and journal and photograph and annotate photographs, write poetry about what, however you want to take what you see and put it into some form that I can experience too. And you'll do that every week. And what I think, as you may know from our previous conversations, I know you do, it's always interesting to see how each student picks a tree. And that's really one of the wonderful surprises for me each year.
I remember you told me that what speaks to them is maybe that there's a shared ancestry, that because you have a renowned collection of plants of Asia, for example, and some students with Asian backgrounds in their family history may have said, "Oh, wow, that's the same from the same place as my, grandmother or great grandmother or whatever," and things like that. And others, look at them, the physical stature or lack of stature. Some of them are oddball shapes, and some of them are giants, and so lots of different attractions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm actually writing these days about what I call plant ambassadorhood, and the idea that if you have provenance on your plants, plants in our collections can be these connectors to culture, cultures around the world that you may have heritage with, and so it's been a very interesting journey for me to see that. And often students may pick, for example, a Native American student might pick a sugar maple because that's a really important tree in her cultural history and continuing cultural history.
Right.
Or a Korean or Korean American student might pick a tree that whose seed was collected in Korea. So these become, I think, really interesting ways in which the tree isn't just a tree. It becomes emblematic of something. And so it goes beyond just the tree. But then you have people like you mentioned stature, who want something intimate. They want a small tree that they can just sort of, the scale is almost human. And then I have people who just are overwhelmed by an old dawn redwood, and they just can't imagine something. And so it's a very personal thing, but each
Yeah.
student will be able to articulate why they picked that tree, which I think is wonderful.
And then the other one of the other elements, and in terms of, let's if we sort of transition to like, okay, so I'm not a first year student at Harvard, and I'm not going to take, unfortunately, going to come and take your seminar. But if we were translating some of the elements of it, of a sort of do it yourself at home kind of thing, or for that matter, in your local arboretum, wherever you are, or in the park, or down the street, or whatever, in the forest nearby. There's also these readings. So it's not like there's a botany textbook and you read chapter one the first week and chapter two the second week and whatever and have a quiz. It's like you have this diversity of readings that further illuminate the subject, you know, both the tree and the connection, the idea of, you know, building empathy and the other, knowing the other. And I think as you said to me when we did the time story, you know, sort of learning to love something that can't necessarily love you back. Yeah.
Exactly right. And I think that's where, reading literature, reading the first chapter of Richard Powers' The Overstory about the immigrant family and chestnuts. And it's a beautiful, beautiful sort of examination of a family over generations and just an individual tree. Or Robin Wall Kimmerer in the Council of Pecans and her Braiding Sweetgrass. And you get these opportunities to read about trees. We also have poetry that we read about, for example, abscission in the fall when leaves fall off, or one of my favorite phenomena, which is marcescence, which is when deciduous woody plants don't drop their leaves in the fall,
Yes.
but they hold them shivering through the winds and the snow, like beech trees and young oaks and other things. And we also read some pretty serious science. We actually go back in time to imagine a world that didn't have trees, and what would it have been like? And then what were the first forests like back 385 million years ago? But interestingly, I can pair that paper and that science with some writings of Lucretius in On the Nature of Things. He writes about this great race of herbaceous plants to race to the sky to be the first one there. And amazingly, that little passage from Lucretius is a perfect encapsulation of the Devonian. Obviously, he was speculating, but I think that that means that there are so many different ways that people can interact with, read about, and then engage with trees that that I actually really enjoy the fact that it isn't a science class. It
Right.
has some science in it, and there's no question that that can be a lot of fun about the science of fall colors, why some leaves are red, why some are yellow, why there are more red-colored fall woody plants in New England than there are in Europe. Well, we can do those things, but it's kind of a fun thing. And then what do we do after we've had our discussion? We march out there and look at fall colors, and that's pretty
Right.
great.
Right. And so you know, here from the ancient Roman poet, like you said, Lucretius, you know, to contemporary literature, you know, it's a real the syllabus. And what I'll do is I'll give with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. I'll give some of where I can find a link to either the whole piece of literature or how to get it or whatever. I'll give some links so that people can find what we're talking about.
Oh, please do. So after the New York Times piece that you so wonderfully, really captured the bottled essence of the class, we have posted my syllabus on the Arboretum website, and I would love anyone who wishes to engage with this material. If you want to self-assemble a group of friends in your neighborhood or town that love the woods and trees and so forth, you can do it, or you can get together on Zoom with friends and pick a tree and meet weekly. But this is all meant to be shared with anyone in the world who'd
Right.
like to engage.
Well, that's great that the syllabus is online. That's great. One of the the stories that you have people read is by Carson McCullers, called A Tree, A Rock, A Cloud. And that kind of blew me away. I don't know if I'd ever read it, but when I did, and I don't know if you want to give the short version of it or what, but wow, it was like what an unexpected, and again, juxtaposed against, in the syllabus also some scientific papers and some history papers and some other kinds of literature. It was really startling, really a beautiful piece.
Yeah, that piece of that short story, which really, I mean, it's just a very short story, I think has become something so central to sort of the giving voice to the way I think about what nature can do. And it's actually came, I was introduced to it from a session called Should Trees Have Legal Standing, in which we read what is a really classic piece of writing by a law professor, Christopher Stone, who was at the University of Southern California. From a case in which there was an attempt to prevent a big development in the mountains in Southern California that would have been, I think, a Disney operation, and the question was, who could sue on behalf of this ecosystem of these trees? And in the end, it went to the Supreme Court, and the trees did not win. But what's
Right.
interesting is Stone wrote this very powerful thing: Should Trees Have Legal Standing? And he was actually a philosophy concentrator at Harvard, so he was very well and widely read. And in this piece, he references Carson McCullers. And that was my introduction. And in this
Huh.
short story, I immediately connected. It's a nice 1950s piece of a diner in the morning. There are men in it on their way to work, having their coffee, and there's a boy who's a paper boy who comes in for his coffee, and there's a sort of a vagrant man who's in there, who starts to talk to this boy, and the boy doesn't quite know what's going on, but he begins to tell a story of how he fell in love years ago and with a woman who he married, and then eventually, and not you know, and if, after a few years she leaves him, and he spends years trying to find her, but to no avail, and then he realizes sort of an interesting insight, which is maybe he wasn't ready for human love. And that there's a science to going about how to be able to love. And he talks about building up his practice. That he says to the boy, I think at one point, I can love anything. And this comes back to what I think of as unreciprocated love. And he
Yeah.
talks about, I can love a cloud, I can love a tree, I can love a rock. And he really is in this process of saying, I don't start at the deep end with human love, but build your practice up so that you can love anything and be ready for that. And he turns to the natural world. And of course, this boy is taking it in, not quite sure what to make of it. But of course, the essence of that story is that humans should and can become more loving, more capable of empathy by turning to the natural world. And I just think it's beautiful to read that story and
Yeah,
ponder.
it's really it, and that one I was able to find, online and so forth even. It's really it's oof, it just gives me the shivers.
Me
I love,
too, me
and in the
too.
sort of opening scene, the man, he's like, I think he's like hunched over his beer in one you hear it is morning in one corner of the diner, and he as the boy comes in, he calls out to the boy, I love you. And that's, I think, how the exchange begins. And it's like exactly what he said, right? Like he's learned that, even a stranger to open up our hearts like that and see what happens, right?
Right. And I think, and that the short stories, you can, if you can't find it online, you can order from Amazon,
Sure.
or go to your local bookstore, hopefully. And but I think this business of learning to love without sort of assuming you'll be loved back is a powerful sort of way of thinking, especially in the world now, where so much of what we're surrounded by is sort of an initial take, which is to hate or
Yeah.
to suspect or to oppose, and it never lets anything in. And I think one of the things that I think you and I connected very much on in our conversations and for the New York Times pieces, I want this course to be a hopeful course, a way of thinking that we all, in our own small ways, can go about a practice that will help us make the world in our own little corners collectively better and more loving,
Right.
more sympathetic, empathetic, more capable of not having an initial reaction like, you're not like me, therefore there's something wrong.
Right. Not finger pointing at the other, like I'm good, you're bad, because you're the other. Not that kind that which we see in everything today, it seems like.
That's
Right.
right.
So we have maybe 4 or 5 minutes something left, so if I want to do this myself, I've got to go out and pick a tree.
You do.
That's really, really hard. And we talked about some of the ways that the students, what influences them or whatever. And so each week then they write something about it or draw something about it or all of the above, take pictures of it, whatever they sort of learn about it by interacting with it in those sort of like creative ways or
That's
documenting it in those ways
yeah,
or
that's and this really can be, if you're living in, in New York City, it can be a tree you walk by every day and may not have even given a second thought to. And all of a sudden, if you pick that tree and you say, every week I'm just going to be looking at this tree for half an hour and I'm going to be thinking about it, you've begun the journey.
Okay.
All of a sudden you're looking at bark. Before you know it, if you pick it, depending on the season, you're seeing buds flush, as we will, and maybe you've never looked at what does a winter bud look like, or a dormant bud look like on this tree next to you. Maybe then, oh, I see there's scars on this, the twigs, that must be where the leaves were attached last year, and then the buds flush, and to me, there is nothing more beautiful than seeing leaf out in the spring. It's just It's such an ephemeral kind of a thing for each tree, and so I think there is no one way to pick a tree, it doesn't really matter. You create your own reasons. This is why I think it's very empowering that and important that I not sort of tell people what to do, it because it doesn't matter. It's the journey you and a tree will have, and over weeks and weeks and weeks. That tree will become something quite different than it was in ways where you will feel, I think, a strong attachment to that tree, but one that's grounded in what I think of as giving that tree standing. Actually saying, this is a one-to-one relationship. That tree has a life journey just as I do. It's not just an anonymous background piece of green. And then anyone can do this. And I think what's exciting is when you have a group of people that are doing it, you can actually ex talk to each other about it through your photographs,
Right.
through, as I say, I've had students who've written poetry about their trees. I've
Didn't you
had,
have like a craft project or
oh,
two?
absolutely. Oh,
I
yeah. I had a student who crocheted a dawn redwood.
Oh.
So yeah, I again, this is the important thing here is not to be prescriptive, but to open through this course and through the syllabus and through these practices that I encourage to let everyone make it their own, and to make it their own journey. And I think if you do that alone, which I think is a wonderful thing, or you do it with a partner or a spouse or with your children or with friends, there's just no one way to do it. But part of it is you have this conversation, in a sense, or this back and forth with the tree. The tree is there, but now your eyes can see it and take it in, and you can do anything you want to sort of document and ponder.
I'm just gonna have to pick. It's really gonna be really, really hard because I'm in love with the number of the trees here.
Well, and I will tell you can pick one tree, and then maybe you say, I'm going to try that practice on another tree at another time. And because
Okay.
I don't know that I would be, I have a lot of trees I'd pick.
Well, again, you have 16,000 woody
Yeah.
plants there to look
And
at.
I might actually, if I was to ask to pick now, I might say there's certain things, there's certain trees here I have to return to all the time, every
Yeah.
year.
Yeah.
But maybe it would be, if I was going to say, what would I do? Maybe I'd want to find a tree I'd never really noticed. Because, and then I, it's funny, we had a wonderful talk about our expedition to Bosnia Herzegovina this fall to collect the Bosnian spruce, which is this magnificent skinny spruce, but you know, quite endangered. And we have the seeds, and we have some of them on the ground. But all of a sudden, after this talk, I walked out the door of the building, and I said, I knew there were two of them just 150 feet from that front door. But I had never really looked at them carefully.
Yes, I know.
So I
Isn't
was
it
just
amazing?
mortified.
Yeah,
But
yeah, yeah.
someone had given me the portal. And then I thought, what would be more fun? What could be more fun than maybe those are the trees I'd pick, because I had been not observing them.
Yes. Well, I'm always glad to talk to you, Ned, and always glad to think about the Arnold Arboretum. And I'll include information about visiting, of course, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com and the link to our Times story together and things like that. So, and obviously the Arnold website, which is so full of information about so many incredible woody plants. So thank you for making time today.
Oh, thank you, Margaret. It is always such a wonderful thing to have a conversation with you.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'll talk to you again soon. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and RobinHoodRadio.com.